So I think we can get started. Folks will pass trickle in. My name is Travis. Thanks for coming to this session on remediating toxic masculinity. I just wanted to start by saying a couple of disclaimers about the session. First, I'm not an authority figure on this topic. I'm not a woman and gender studies professor. I have been interested in feminism and toxic masculinity for a long time, and have started to think about this in relationship to the environment and wanted to just bring that to your attention. I also am not necessarily like asking you to help me as a man figure this out for me. This is a conversation that I think is just important to have at Holden and is important to put into the context of our place. Why I'm doing this session is because I have a mother and grandparents, grandmothers, and a sister, and a partner, all of whom I love very much, and I think it's really important for me as a man to kind of come to terms with this particular topic and think about it in relationship to the actions that we engage in. So I want to start by...
Before we start, can you turn the these lights this way?
Yes, yeah.
We can't see you.
Well, we don't want that.
We can hear you.
Is that too dark? We're good? Okay. So I want to start with sort of a definition for toxic masculinity. Does anyone want to volunteer to read this?
Toxic masculinity refers to the social expectations that men, and thus boys, should be sexually aggressive, physically violent, unemotional, homophobic, and should also devalue women.
Thanks. So this is by a woman named Ruth White, and she is an author on a lot of books on bipolar disorder in particular, but she talks a lot about psychology, and she's written a lot of articles on psychology and the intersection of toxic masculinity with psychology. So this is one definition that has been supplied. What this kind of translates to in a lot of situations is a specific idea of masculinity that is pushed by society at large. So ideas that men ought be self-reliant, that they ought not cooperate with other people, that there should be extreme competition, sort of a role of dominance in the individual sphere, that you should have dominance as a male over all things in your life, which has implications, obviously, for relationships with other people. Displays of strength, kind of being really macho, being unemotional, not showing emotions other than maybe aggression or anger, and then enforcing traditional roles. So when you think about what is like manly in society, a lot of times people associate that masculinity with these ideas. And what toxic masculinity tries to do is say that that conception of masculinity is quite toxic to society and to men themselves, and especially the people around them who they're affecting. The consequences are obviously an attitude of male superiority, that men are better than women or other gender identities, an attitude of sexual violence towards women, and that women are objects, a lack of cooperation with practically everyone around them, definitely excess risk. You mean, think about who are explorers traditionally and who are a lot of the folks who have pushed to climb mountains, right, and this kind of risk-taking that's associated with the masculine idea. And then especially a suppression of emotions of themselves and the men and boys around them, and then psychological self-harm that comes from that suppression of emotions. You can see this playing out in a lot of different places in society, but what I'm interested in is seeing what y'all think. So maybe we can start with this question. Where do you see toxic masculinity in daily life? And maybe you can turn to one or two people around you, kind of group up, and spend about 5 minutes talking about that. And then we'll come back together. So let's come back together here. And if you feel comfortable sharing, I would really like to get some stuff up on the board for where we might see toxic masculinity in our daily lives.
Politics?
Yeah, I figured we could just come out and say it.
Yeah,
I'm letters.
but not just Donald Trump, right? And I think it's something that's straddled all presidencies. It's not something unique to,
you know.
Except I think it's more on display right now.
Definitely.
Than it was during our last administration.
Well, and I heard several people when the presidential race was going that my own husband, bless his heart, ranted and raved, "You're just going to vote for Taylor because she's a woman. No,
yeah.
I'm going to vote for her because I think she's smarter than Donald."
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But, he would draw those lines that you're only going to vote for the women on the docket.
Mm-hmm.
No, I'm going to vote for the people that I think have the best qualifications.
Right.
That's why they give you a bio in the
Me Too movement,
mm-hmm.
or the what resulted in the Me Too movement.
Job opportunities.
Job
pay.
Mm-hmm. Just jobs in general.
Yeah.
Right. Valuing of traditionally male tasks over
mm-hmm.
female tasks in the household or in the world, like the nurturing, caring, cleaning, hospitality things are all less valued.
Mm-hmm.
Sports.
Sports? Yeah, for sure.
Especially football.
Well, I'm not in the military, too.
No.
That's sort of a textbook example of the masculinity values that we talk about.
Even the pay disparity in women's professional sports compared to
men. Oh.
Yeah. And the reporting.
Yes.
Yeah.
Along with Donald Trump, the idea that there's such a thing as locker room talk or boy talk that's okay.
Mm-hmm.
Stereotypes like women aren't as good at math,
mm-hmm.
for instance.
Mm-hmm. What about like in your personal relationships or in relationships in general?
Misuse of power, we talked about misuse of power in relationships.
Mm-hmm.
We talked about veterans coming home from, like, World War II, for example, and not being able to talk about their experiences
mm-hmm.
and kind of what they went through and just get that out and how it affected them.
Just like a general suppression of emotions.
Yeah.
Whereas if it had been female veterans, it might have been totally different.
I'm
a high school teacher, and I see it in the difference in some ways between the male teachers in my building and the female teachers, the way we structure our classrooms, and also I watch it in interactions between students, and I find that boys, my male students are more, just talk up more, are louder, are more kind of in control of the classroom a lot while the girls sit quietly.
Sugar and spice and everything nice.
Yeah.
What are the books
supposed to
be? Someone had shared with me yesterday about like our ideas about creativity and artistry and how like when you're starting to get into the arts, oftentimes this is associated with like being feminine, right? Like expressing yourself is a feminine thing. Yet when we think about through history who are the most revered artists, they almost always are male. And so at a certain point, when you're the best, it becomes
a masculine
thing.
Well, cooking is supposed to be
a
girl's job.
I was just saying
until
that.
She becomes a chef, and then she can't be a chef.
Right.
It's got to be a man's job.
Yeah.
Jackie talked about the church, and what we carry forward from what we've learned as young people, whatever church we're part of.
Mm-hmm.
Even in the
the church, we talked about that male tasks, traditionally male tasks are valued over female tasks, whether it's preaching versus pastoral care.
Yeah, so, I mean, tons of places that we can see this playing out in our daily lives. So, a particular philosopher named Karen Warren writes a lot about ecofeminism, and she sort of suggests in some of her writing that a lot of the systems of oppression that we experience in daily life, like environmental degradation, sexism, racism, ageism, classism, xenophobia, anti-Semitism, homophobia, colonialism, Islamophobia, and all other forms of oppression, are really derivative of this idea of a logic of dominance, which is to say that because I am something, and because you are something that is different, and I believe that that something that's different is lesser, that I am justified in my oppression of you. And that fundamentally, the same logic of dominance that allows men to believe that they are better than women and put forth forms of oppression through things like toxic masculinity is the same logic of dominance that has led to environmental degradation. The idea that I'm a human, this is life, I am supposed to be the steward of that life, I am better than that life, and so I can treat that life in what way that I see fit. Furthermore, she goes to argue this. Does anyone want to volunteer to read?
Failure to make visible these interconnected twin dominations, male dominance and dominance of nature, results in an inaccurate account of how it is that nature has been and continues to be dominated and exploited.
Thanks. I mean, basically, she says that if we fail to recognize this common root and we don't intertwine them, that ultimately we don't have a solid ethic and a solid foundation for really addressing the problem. So what I want to talk about next is where we might see male dominance or toxic masculinity in our relationship to nature. So ways in which we might see that playing out in our relationship to nature. And maybe we can get back together with our groups and spend another 5 minutes chatting. All right, so let's bring it back together. What were some of the things you talked about? Yeah, Kate?
So going back to the beginning of our country, people came here to own land. So that's a deep masculine root. And then if you own land, you can do whatever you want with it.
And the only people who owned land were white men.
And you could only vote if you owned land.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Which kind of brings us to what our group has tied all this into: greed, which is not just a masculine trait, but we keep going back to greed.
Mm-hmm. Which I think goes along with competition in a big way.
Yeah.
I was thinking about how, in terms of jobs, like the concrete, task-oriented, male, supposedly male jobs are valued more than the relational female things, and that relates to like the idea that we need to drill in the Arctic wildlife refuge because we need to make some use and get money out of that, those resources, and exploit them, as opposed to thinking of it as a relationship with the land. Mm-hmm.
But if we all did that, we would not have the system of economics that we have now.
Did what?
If we all thought of ourselves in relationship with the land instead of exploiting the land, then we'd have to really rethink our economics.
Oh, yeah, no, for sure.
Which might be.
I don't know that we can have a balance.
I'm sure we
just
can make
that
a compromise. It's all about compromise. Life is about compromise.
But capitalism just tends to bulldoze everything in its path. Sometimes
it has to grow.
So maybe you could even say like our very system of resource extraction is rooted in a masculine idea of competition as being.
Yeah.
Even the kinder, gentler variety.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was thinking about in the book of Genesis, even to kind of take a little theological perspective, the way that human beings or man or Adam and Eve were put like in charge of, like to watch over it. There's this sort of power and dominance just inherent in the kind of creation myth, creation story that we're taught from when we were little in the church.
Which is not unique to Christianity. I mean,
it's not, right.
More or less uniform.
But there's this power, instead of like, you're called to coexist or to live, you know, it's this like power structure. Yeah. Let's put it.
Yeah. Dominion versus
dominion.
So, and one might even say, right, like we look to a lot of early environmental thinkers like Alda Leopold and Thoreau as being these sort of ideal people, but inherently it's like a stewardship thing, and to an extent stewardship is still dominion based. Mm-hmm. Saying I as the steward have the authority to steward.
Conservation.
Well, and we live in a world where we have to take from the earth to survive. We can't do it. We can't survive without taking.
I was
and there's better ways of taking and maybe more exploitative ways of taking, but we can't not take.
Yeah.
We were talking about hunting and sort of that Native American tradition of really giving thanks for that animal, which is sustaining them, versus like trophy hunting that's like for the sake of that trophy. And
yeah, not showing an emotional connection with what you're taking from.
What if we took enough, but not more than we needed?
Sustainability.
Lack of sustainability.
Lack of
taking more.
Well, here's another word too: sacramental. It could be a visible sign of God's grace, and then we aren't so apt to grab and take from others if we have that frame of mind.
What about like National Geographic?
Yeah.
Or Backpacker magazine. Or even like, you know, Nature magazine, scientific magazine, or anything like that. I mean, I think a lot of what we're focusing on in terms of how we're writing and who we're covering and all that sort of thing is really still male-centered too.
Yeah, we were kind of discussing the concept of the YIM, the young invincible male.
Yes.
And going out into nature and doing things that aren't respectful of the power of nature just because you want that thrill or that story that you can tell that makes you look that little bit more competent or masculine or whatever. Even, you know, you might cross the avalanche, you definitely shouldn't cross and die, but it's worth doing because you might have that story.
That's a trophy.
It's similar to hunting. It's just how you're doing it.
And I think it's interesting how that ideal gets pushed then even onto like non-masculine places, right? Like at Holden, I see like this sort of idea of a yin is like gets pushed onto women as well. It's like, oh, like if you want to be the woman who relates to the environment, then you should take on this, you know, courageous ideal, which
push
is
back,
right. Pushing that toxic masculinity even outside of the bounds of what is masculine.
But is courage only a masculine trait?
So yeah, and that's a great question, right? Is there certainly there are forms of masculinity that may not be toxic.
I can't name the hormone, but there's some hormone that men have much more of than women. Well, that's not it, but it's in risk-taking, that men are more likely to take risks, and it's a hormone.
And it peaks when they're 25.
Pardon me?
That hormone level peaks when they're around mid-20s.
So for May, for me.
Sorry. You're peaking.
So
your days are on your camp.
Perspective on this, like, because I think a lot, I prefer, you know, hiking and listening quietly to nature versus riding on an ATV or a snowmobile or a jet ski, but also, like, we risk more class divisions because if we say, you know, we're better than you because we have less impact, better than you jet skiers or whatever, snowmobilers.
Yes.
Yeah, which is that's really interesting. There's a huge critique from an ecofeminist perspective of the sort of educated, liberal, upper class perspective on the environment, where we often say like, oh, you as the mine worker, you are more environmentally destructive than me. Mm-hmm. Whereas in some situations, they might be economically forced into a situation to be more exploitative. Whereas my complacency and being a wealthy person and flying all over the place to recreate in the environment may actually be more harmful.
Right, right.
Yeah. Which is...
The carbon footprint for the poor guy working in the mines is minuscule compared to the guy just sitting around the
block. Right, or the person living in the apartment in the city versus the person in the big suburban house with the big lawn and the, you know, 4,000 square foot house with 7 TVs and 4 cars.
Yep.
Yeah.
So, next I want to talk about toxic masculinity at Holden and historically how there are some sort of common threads of toxic masculinity causing some environmental degradation. intuitive, right? So this picture is taken in, I think, the late 19-teens. This gentleman with the bushy mustache is the guy after which we're named, James Henry Holden. And this is his cabin and his crew of workers who had started to dig in tunnels into the side of Copper Peak to extract ore out of the mountain. So to give just kind of a brief history, this is another picture of him when he was younger. In 1896, prospectors had started cruising up the valley looking for copper, and one of those prospectors was James Henry Holden. Shortly before that, or if not that summer, prospectors had decided that the best way to find the ore in the valley would be to light things on fire, burn down the forest. Okay, we're starting to see some parallels here. This is a picture from up by Heart Lake, and this is Railroad Creek going down. Holden would be now about here, and all of these little popsicle sticks here are the remains of the trees that got burnt up in that fire. And if you saw on the previous picture, you can see that there isn't a forest up on the side of Copper Peak because they had burned it down. So when we get to the very roots of the attitudes towards the valley, just when people were coming in, it was quite exploitative, it's an object, I have dominion over it, I can be destructive. Another part of that period was extreme competition. Holden got a lot of funding from several different male funders, and he cut them out of all of the benefits of the mine property once he got those claims, which I think shows a little bit of sort of how the competitive nature led to competing exploitation in the valley. In 1897, he filed claims to have ownership over the ore body on the site of Copper Peak. Now let's just think about that. You can just make a claim on the land, and it's now yours. Mm-hmm. It's just that's all you have to do. You just have to show that there's ore there and that you are competent at being able to extract that. That's the origin of our story. Then you go forward, and for the next 20 years or so, Holden had developed the mine, started to dig into the side of Copper Peak with his crew, and build some of the buildings and the early infrastructural development. In 1918, he died of cancer, and it changed hands to another man, Crocker Perry, who was a wealthy business person from Chelan, who continued to do the development of the mine, start building the road up the valley, until in 1928, Howe Sound, which is a mining company from British Columbia, purchased the claims and started developing what would become the fully operating copper mine. Unfortunately for them, or fortunately for the environment, stock market crashing did not bode well for that development, and they basically had to put it off for about a decade until 1937, when the price of copper was starting to creep up, and they could begin to develop Holden Village and the mill workings and all the stuff that was required to pull copper out of the mountain. In 1937, in 1938, they started mining, and for 20 years, it was the second largest copper mine basically in the country. They extracted about 212 million pounds of copper in that 20 years. They made about $66 million in revenue. It was a big mine, it was a big operation, and they had roughly 700 people at peak working and living in the valley. So a very, very big footprint. In 1957, the mine closed, because economic vitality couldn't support the operation. There was still ore in the mountain, and they didn't have the oomph to be able to support that extraction. So when we go back to that development, these pictures are a little bit difficult to see, but this is from 1901, starting to build the road that we use to get up to the valley. You can see everyone is a male in the picture, and they just blasted away the pathway in order to build that road. This image here is actually from up on the side of Copper Peak, or now what is Honeymoon Heights. The village would be down here. Railroad Creek kind of ribbons through here. And it's some of the initial buildings that they used to house those workers. Upon opening the mine, the workers decided that they had to tunnel into the ore body, which was more or less vertical, and they would blast away at the rock to have that sort of crumble down, and then they'd cart it out in a little train, crush it up in the mill structure, add some chemicals, pull out only 3% of that initial rock, and then leave behind 97% of that rock, which amounted to about 10 million tons worth of tailings material in the valley. This image shows a pretty big expansion of the infrastructure. You can see the start of the tailings getting built. This is the mill structure, the road structure, some initial piles that Holden and his crew and Crocker Perry had dug in, and then the village itself, starting to take up a pretty significant footprint in the valley. When we look at the operation, again, almost all male workers in the mine. I don't know of a single account of a woman who worked as a miner inside of the mine or even had a higher up position in the mine. They would go inside, blast away the material, take it out in that sort of a cart structure. They'd crush it up in those cylinders that had a bunch of steel balls that would crush up the material inside of this mill, and then they'd ship it out by vehicle down to the lake and then barge it out. All these photos are from a photographer whose name is Larry Penworthy. And when you look at sort of the imprint on the valley, it was quite extreme. So you've got the starting of the formation of the tailings, you've got this swath of forest that's now the village instead of a functioning ecosystem. You've got the distribution of the tailings throughout the valley. This is actually a picture from our site. That's how they built it. They just took sort of a slurry of the crushed up rock in wooden pipes and then raked it out. And then this, I think, is really an interesting picture. This is Winston. So if you go out towards the ball field, this is the 103 homes that existed between Holden and the ball field. So we're talking a really massive footprint. And not until 1955 was there any sort of legislation that really held the mine company accountable at all. And even at that point, there wasn't much enforcement of that legislation. So what are some of the consequences we get from this? It's not limited to this, but this is some of the ones that I've discussed with other people and people have shared with me. So obviously the destruction of nature, right? Mining is an incredibly environmentally degrading process. I think making toxic masculinity really commonplace, right? Justifying and saying, hey, you know, when we go to like museums in the West, or we go to, I don't know if you've ever been to Rocky Reach Dam Museum, it's a very interesting place where like this sort of exploration and dominion over nature is really idealized. So saying, you know, it's okay, this cell phone in my pocket, oh, it's fine to have this masculinity spilling out into the environment and destroying the environment, dominating it, because I want to have my phone in my pocket. I want to have access to this sort of technology and this sort of quality of life. Think the mess that's left behind, right? So we've got polluted water from the metals that have been freed by the mining that's now leaching into the environment and causing degradation to the stream. And then obviously the tailings, which you can see from space very easily, occupying about 120 acres on the other side of the creek. And another thing is an enforcement of roles. Even just saying that this sort of dominating activity is being done by men. The majority of the people who are working in the mine are males. I think even further, Holden certainly had a really respectful and sort of family-centered community for a portion of the mining era, but there was also a brothel just across the lake at Moore Point. and there was quite a lot of womanizing that happened associated with the mine. There was a lot of sort of male-only spaces, like the gambling hall, and some of the tavern spaces down in Lucerne. So I think a lot of that sort of enforcement of male roles in that community and in that operation was really prevalent. So then we get to another chapter of toxic masculinity in the environment, mine remediation, right? One thing I think is fascinating is the idea of the hero and the damsel in distress. There's an author, a philosopher, whose name is Marty Keel, who puts out the idea that this is an incredibly problematic complex, where basically men think, or it's a masculine idea, to think that I, the hero, can save the situation and save the damsel in distress, Mother Nature, no matter what. And that ultimately that idea is still rooted in a toxic masculinity, of that I as the male can fix the problem. So when we look at it through this lens, come on, it's the most phallic thing that's ever been told. But just to put it in that perspective, I think is an interesting idea. So to give some context, in 1961, Holden Village was formed by a series of events. Essentially, a gentleman named Wes Preve writing letters to the mining company, trying to convince them to donate the site to Lutheran College north of Seattle to create Holden Village as a retreat center. And finally, he was successful. They asked for a $100,000 tax write-off and got that. And the gift of the village was given. And Holden Village was formed in 1961 to start our operation. Not until 1989 was there any significant remedial work done. In 1989, the Forest Service did a small tailings rehabilitation effort, which at the time was a pretty big deal. It cost them several $1 million. And they tried capping the top of the tailings piles with some dirt and rock, doing some replanting, and then doing some bank stabilization. That wasn't successful at really fixing the problem, and they burnt through quite a lot of fuel and quite a lot of money in an effort to do that. So they decided that the agencies, so the Forest Service, the Department of Ecology, and the Environmental Protection Agency, ought to find who should clean up the site. And they held responsible the company that had bought the company, which had bought the company, which had bought the company, which had bought House Sound, and said, hey, you made the mess, you've got to come clean it up. So they took on that liability. They were purchased by another company, knowing that that company would take on the liability, and that company's name is Rio Tinto. They're one of the largest mining companies in the world, second largest mineral extractor presently, and they took on the responsibility for the cleanup. So finally in 2011, after a lot of deliberation over what they should do, they started that operation. And for about 5 years of heavy construction and summer of planting last year, they had a pretty dominant presence in the valley remediating the site. And just really this year is kind of the first remediation-free summer where we won't have that much work happening in the valley.
So in what way does that illustrate the damsel in distress of
getting there.
Okay.
So, to just give again some more scientific understanding of the problem, so the environmental degradation is really caused by this sort of leaching of metals that have now been freed by the crushing up of the rock. And as water and air comes in, it binds to those metals, pulls them out of the rock, and that leaches out into the environment, causing a change in the acidity of the water, making it more corrosive, and introducing a lot of metals that are really, really bad for fish, plants, and ourselves. In order to try and remedy that environmental harm, the strategy of the mine remediation company and the agencies was to do three things: to cap, collect, and clean. Cap all the tailings with dirt and rock, to collect all the contaminated water, and then to treat that contaminated water. So through this process, it was an enormous amount of changing of the landscape and moving material around. This is an image of the tailings beforehand. We've got a really steep gradation. These are people, to give it a perspective. They were right up along the creek. And now they've been set back considerably, covered with 2 to 3 feet of rock and dirt. and replanted with 70,000 trees and shrubs. This is an incredibly time-intensive process and required a lot of blasting, engineering, and moving of things around. And I think it's just interesting to note that the plan for the landscape is very controlled, very designed. It's taking it in a computer and sort of employing that in the environment instead of really looking for natural ways and themes of organizing that landscape. It was really interesting when talking with some of the folks who had, from the agency side of things, they sent out the initial draft to say, hey, we want a bunch of drain ditches put around the site so that we can intercept some surface water so it's not picking up a lot of those metals in the tailings. And the first draft was literally a straight line blasted through the rock from one point of the site to about a mile away that would have required an enormous amount of fuel, an enormous amount of blasting to just fix a really, you know, simple thing, which is to try and make the water drain in a different route. And I think that sort of mentality really influenced the project. Perhaps the most controlling aspect of the project is the collection system. So this image from a paper published by Rio Tinto shows how they addressed the water issue. They plugged up the mine and set a bunch of pipes into it, but for a lot of the tailings, they couldn't collect that groundwater without building some sort of barrier between the tailings and the creek. So they decided to build a barrier wall that right now at its deepest is 92 feet deep and 3 feet wide that goes from the surface down to bedrock to intercept groundwater that's contaminated before it can get into Roer Creek. They then put in a series of pipes on the inside that catches that contaminated water and pipes it down to a water treatment plant. Again, our giant excavator here, which had to come up in multiple pieces, was sort of the main implement of that process. And it took an enormous amount of time and blasting of rock and boulders underground to allow that excavator to sort of scrape away at that material. This is an image of the site, and the barrier wall basically runs from where Copper Peak goes right up against the creek over to opposite of the ball field, over to our footbridge, and then just past Copper Creek to the majority of the way around the tailings. So it's, I think right now it's just shy of 4,000 feet long. And then ultimately all of this makes its way into a water treatment plant where they add in lime and other chemicals, which is really basic, that glops together with those acidic metals and helps to sort of shift and change them to glop to one another instead of the oxygen that's in the water or in the air. And that falls out as a sludge in these big cylindrical tanks after getting mixed up by a big cake mixer that introduces the chemicals that bind those metals together. It falls out as that sludge, which they dry out and then end up putting back on top of the tailings. Because there are 56 miles of tunnel in the mountain, and because there are about 8.5 million tons of tailings exposed in the outside, this process is going to take basically forever to take all the metals that are in those different areas and convert them into this sludge form, which has some pretty significant implications for our dominion of the valley going forward.
So what is the sludge composed of? What does it become after it's, when it's been put back on top of the tailings?
It's mostly iron. That's naturally occurring in the rock in high concentrations that's holding the metals together. So it's chemically not that different from what the tailings were initially. It's just that they've made it a little bit more basic, less acidic, so that it's stuck to one another instead of free in the environment.
Makes it a harder surface so you can't blow off?
No, it still feels just like good old tailings. It's just that when you pour water over it, it doesn't make as dark of a liquid. There's not as many metals that are leaching out.
Is it so it isn't as porous? Is that what you're saying?
No, it's still porous. It's just that the metals are chemically stuck to one another, so they can't bind to water as easily. So you can, they don't get carried away by the water into the environment. So when you think about the consequences of this, I think you all of a sudden see the enormous cost that's associated with it. So far, we're about 600 million U.S. dollars in running that tab, several million dollars a year for fuel costs down to plant. One thing I think is important that is a really strong parallel with ideas of toxic masculinity is not recognizing the consequences of it. So going and saying, I'm going to be competitive, I'm going to be aggressive, I'm going to be dominant, and not really assessing what comes from that. And the carbon footprint is a significant consequence that wasn't recognized because of hasty decision making. So far, there's been about 1,000 to 4,500 gallons of diesel used per day throughout most of the operation. And that's figures that Rio Tinto gave us. Going forward, the water treatment plant is estimated to take about 160,000 gallons of diesel per year to operate because they chose to use diesel instead of building a hydroelectric plant to offset some of those costs. And again, that's a figure that Rio's given us. That's a significant cost. That carbon footprint is about on par with somewhere in the range of what they used annually in the heavy construction years here. And to put that in perspective, that's about 60 Americans' carbon emissions per year, even just the low end of 1,000 gallons per day. So we're running into a pretty big carbon footprint and a pretty big consequence.
Could they have gotten permits to put in a hydroelectric plant?
They could still. Yep.
How much does Holden use annually, diesel?
Less than about 10,000 gallons. So then I think also the wide logging footprint is another part of this hasty process. There was a lot of swaths of forest that had to be logged because they wanted to take the quick route, where they could move the arm of their excavator around to get at some areas of the site instead of going and taking a more direct path. So even just after the fire, they were told by the Forest Service that they could cut down a lot of trees that might pose a danger to the road, and they cut about 36 truckloads more than they were supposed to. Which is an enormous amount of trees felled, though they were mostly already dead, that then added more fuel alongside the road that would have been a really bad thing if a fire were to come up. So they actually had to go and pick that all up and stack it down further. But that's sort of, again, lack of reverence, just sort of, we can do what we need to do to get the job done, let's go do it quickly, really conforms to this masculine ideal. I think a suppression of, so the continued pollution of the creek, obviously, creek's not completely cleaned up. If you walk down to the very end of the site, the remediation didn't adequately collect enough of the water. And so we've still got contamination for a large swath of the creek, and we've really got to wait several years to know if that is significant enough to merit another phase of remediation or if it's okay. But there's still contaminated water leaching out. The big one, I think, is a suppression of emotions. Read any language on the remediation project and tell me where you see a strong emotional connection with the benefits of the project. Mm-hmm. It's very flat, very scientifically minded. This is what happened, this is what we did, there's the economic benefit, here's the factual information. Not, wow, we've done some sort of renewal, or wow, we've worked with nature to help it recover from the harm that we've done. That lack of emotion is really, I think, characteristic of a masculine push of ideals. And then with that, a lack of listening. When we start accruing these costs, where are we gonna change? Where are we gonna say, oh, we messed up? That hasn't happened yet. From the agencies or from Rio, at all. And they recognize these costs, but still are not man enough, right? To come up and say, oh, this is what we've done wrong.
So is efficiency a toxic masculine value?
I don't know. I don't know. I don't necessarily know if this is very efficient either.
I mean, what would you have to do? I'm going to be devil's advocate. Considering the extreme character of the degradation from the mine all those years, what would have been a better way? Is it because their attitude was wrong, or because their measures were wrong, or because what?
I don't know. Does anyone have any thoughts?
Well, a lot of us feel that the hydro plant would have been at least better, even though that's at the end. I mean, even just that in itself would have helped pollution and the use of so much burning oil. And it seemed to be, I don't know if it would be more expensive or less. I mean, that didn't seem to be a lot of thought to listen, to think. I don't know that was pursued as it could have been, maybe. But I don't know.
What was the economic benefit that you mentioned?
About half the money went into the regional and local economy. Okay.
Jobs.
And I think what the main retort that people have supplied is that it wasn't really that bad. Majority of the people who were exposed to the pollution were only here for maybe a week or two, and there was no health studies that really associated consequences of this contamination with the people living here. The drinking water, or the water quality of Railroad Creek, met drinking water standards before the project happened. We could have gone and drank the water straight out of Railroad Creek despite its red color. And according to Washington State Department of Ecology standards, which are really strict, it was safe.
So, why was the remediation embarked upon it?
Well, that brings me to my next question. Is ultimately, when we see these parallels between toxic masculinity being played out and employed in this attitude towards remediation, are we responsible? So for a very long time, Holden was a major advocate for the project. Mm-hmm. And furthermore, we can't undo our existence, but if we weren't here, would it have happened? I just think that that's a lot of something we need to wrestle with a little bit. But I also think that there is some beneficial things that we can learn from Holden, right? So the session is entitled Remediating Toxic Masculinity, and so far I've just talked about environmental degradation in relationship to toxic masculinity. And I think some things that have been brought to me by different folks in the community is the idea that how Holden is structured in some ways might be a part of the equation to remedying toxic masculinity, and furthermore remedying some of our negative consequences to the environment. When you think about non-traditional roles, many of the jobs at Holden Village are non-traditional. When I arrived, two of the three carpenters were women, and both of the head mavericks who were doing all the heavy lifting were women as well. The people who started working in the kitchen were mostly a mix of men and women, and our directors and our pastoral roles and our leaders are generally mixed between those various gender identities, which I think is just a part of maybe undoing that complex. Emotional vulnerability is also another key aspect of Holden. It is really enforced that it's important to share our emotions with one another and to be vulnerable through first word, through a Vesper setting, through conversation with each other. And certainly there are exceptions. I think cooperation is another big one, right? We really strongly cooperate here. We have friendly competition, but true competition between one another is actually, I think, kind of strongly frowned upon in the community here. And I also feel like Holden expresses a pretty loving attitude towards nature, where we're trying to listen to how much we're taking from the valley and the ways in which we're sort of degrading that environment. Now, this is only a wedge of maybe a solution, and I only come from my limited background as a man assessing this particular issue. What I'm really interested in is hearing what you all think. So I'd say if we can take maybe 10 minutes to break out into groups and talk about what we might think could be a remediation of toxic masculinity in our own lives or in its relationship to the environment. So we've run a little bit over time, but if you're interested in sticking around and discussing, I'm just curious to hear what y'all came up with.
I think Carol here hit on some really important things. And one was not to blame or shame confirm past actions. We did the best we could at the time. And the second thing is go into a project, whether it's remediation or whether it's like any kind of interaction with the earth, with a real clear idea of what biases we might be bringing into the conversation. Carrying in some of these dominant attitudes, even though we may not know it, whether we're male or female, and just having, putting that on the table first. You know, why are we doing this? What are we doing? What attitudes are we not seeing? And then move forward from there.
Yeah, an interesting connection with the first point you bring up is this fall, James Henry Holden's granddaughter, Kathy Holden, came up for the Minor Union, and she gave a presentation about her family history and didn't really mention any of the negative things associated with James Henry. And I was walking out on the 10-mile Falls Trail doing a fire ecology hike, and she was really knowledgeable about fire ecology. And so I asked afterwards, how have you learned so much? Did you study ecology or have you worked in that? She's like, oh yeah, I've got a master's degree in fire ecology, and I've been an organic foods activist my entire life, and a master gardener. And she proceeded to share with me that she doesn't feel like it's productive to blame because that's what they had at the time. Like, did he really conscientiously come in and say, oh, I'm going to be competitive, or oh, I'm going to be a dominating, or was that a societal value that was pushed onto him? And I think it's difficult to talk about this because you have sort of an obligation to point this stuff out, but how do you...
Everybody wants Satan. I mean, they want a boogeyman in a closet so they can blame somebody.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I also think that we have to learn how to tell our history more truthfully, or else we're not going to make the changes. I mean, it probably would have behooved her to say, hey, you know, there was not another way, but this was, you know, the operation of the time. We can't let that happen again. Mm-hmm. I mean, we don't tell our own history in this country very truthfully.
That's true.
And most of us don't even really know what the truth is. I think, yeah, I think it's sort of imperative on our parts, you know, just directly to this question, to tell our stories more truthfully.
Mm-hmm. I keep wondering what's going to be learned from this minor meeting. What's going to come down the line that we'll have to maybe readjust or find another way to do things as a result of what's been done. It's not over. I'm sorry.
No, I don't think. I mean, I just don't think it.
How many times do you move the furniture in your house? You know, you're always having to tweak something in your life. I mean, that's just life.
The image of that is the building, picture of the building with the big tanks. To me, it looked like the mill site. I just made the parallel that, oh, well, they had those big round tank things in the mill site. And what's going to happen to that someday, because they're going to discover something that's better.
Hand over there.
I really appreciated the ownership that it brought around this idea of masculinity as not being attributed to, like, males or females, but just as this idea of masculinity. And as a woman, I can, like, claim that and see it as my own toxic masculinity and my own consumerism, and people are adding through that contribution, seeing, you know, these are the things that we consume and these are the things that we do, and this is our part of this problem.
Yeah. We're all complicit.
Yeah.
I've had an experience here. I've been here 2 weeks. I'll be here two more weeks. But I made mention at one of the meals to somebody at the table that I'm just really surprised that nobody's talking about the political scene. And the response was, well, out of respect, that's probably well, you know, I was kind of struck with, it's disrespectful to speak your truth about what's going on politically. Mm-hmm. And so I think maybe that could be an improvement if that could be encouraged. Maybe not village-wide, but in smaller gatherings where we can
speak respectfully but differently.
And I from that I didn't think that I can do that. Mm-hmm. I'm reluctant to do that. I don't want to be ostracized some way, mm-hmm. or have a reputation of being a rabble rouser or whatever. And that's the old Scandinavian thing, you know.
You're so nice.
You know, pack it down.
See, I'm passive aggressive.
Well, and I think I would like to do some variation of this session in the summertime, but I'm very concerned about having an audience that might be a little bit more 50-50 men, women, and other gender identities, just knowing that this might be a really difficult topic to discuss with a lot of
people. The topic needs to continue. I mean, all that stuff needs to be kept on the table and aerated, and because something better might come down the road, but we did what we did. They did what they did at the time that they could do, and we do what we can do at the time with what we know. We're going to learn more. Things might change. We might have to redo something, but just sitting around like a jellyfish isn't going to get anything.
And we have to talk beyond the judgment.
Yeah.
So that
we have to decide where we're at and move forward from here.
And we talked a lot about personal, just taking this to the personal level, too. The decisions that we make, had lots of examples, but then to kind of work with education for how to do this better, how to do this, you know, this work of taking care of our environment. And so this piece at Holden that those of us have watched happen for a long, long time, but in our own lives, we see the toxic behavior of all of us as we make poor decisions for our environment, and we put things into place that we don't ask about the long-range impact of our decisions. And so it kind of brings, for me, this all just brings it back to me, because we are fighting toxic power and money, but we still have our local power. We still have the power in here and in our community. And I like your telling the story, because in school districts, where it's not environment, but it is environment, because we're not telling everybody's story. We're not making everybody's story up in the environment. And we do have parts of our environment that are being very great caretakers of the environment. And one of my partners in conversation, you were talking about it, this decision that was made between the Native tribe. You want to tell that?
Oh.
You're going to tell it better, because you know that than me.
Well, my husband's a forester, and we were, I said, wait a minute, there's some good things that happened between, and he was witness to something that happened down around Edenpaw, where the Native tribes who had a part in the decision, and the wildlife people and the forestry people sat down together on a hillside, looked at this drainage, and decided what was best for it. In conversation, wrote up a proposal. Awesome. And he came home from work that day and said, I just saw the most amazing thing. Mm. You know, so those little things do happen. Have a stake in it. That's the word I was looking for. Mm-hmm. That got lost.
Take ownership.
Take ownership.
I don't know if we were a test run for you or not, but I mean, I can tell you took great care in the questions and all of the words and the language you used, and I just feel like you did a really nice job with a really tough kind of conversation to have, and I would hope that you would, I don't know if it needs revision from, you know, Holden's perspective or not, but I mean, people come to Holden to have these conversations that they can't have other places, and they'll tell you that. We don't talk about this in our family, or we don't talk about this in our church, and so Holden, I think, needs to always be a place that can happen. So I really hope you do sort of
you know, challenge and push the edges, you know.
What I've been thinking about is, you know how we've been trying to talk about white privilege here in Hilton and mm-hmm. the last year or so. And I was thinking about, this is like part of that hairball.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
Right? So, I mean, it's like as we start unraveling white privilege mm-hmm. and, you know, begin to tell our stories and begin to hear other stories, you know, that is like, wow, that's a thread of the hairball. I mean, it's mm-hmm. like we have to, mm-hmm. like, I think we have to follow these rabbit trails. Mm-hmm. And I think this is a really important one. And I was so excited to see you offering this because I think it's really important. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it might be not really stirring comfortable, but
it's probably important that it's uncomfortable.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, thanks for coming. If you have any other comments or especially like critiques, I would welcome that. Thanks for coming. Mm-hmm.